Okay, so we are just rolling over to 7:30. So as per usual, I'm going to start the meeting. I will mute all. Everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question, or remute yourself afterwards. And later on this evening, courtesy of Alan's hard work, the contents of the deck, along with the audio track and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website. We have a fairly abbreviated agenda tonight, largely because of the fact that I'm going to take over for a fair amount, and I'll go into detail later on as to exactly why. Hopefully people will find it useful and interesting and comment back on it, because I don't think that I know everything in this particular topic either. So with that, I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Take it away, Alan.
Once he unmutes himself, there we go. Okay. Yes, and for those of you who don't pay attention putting together, welcome to the 195th issue of Q&A, apparently. And you will note that we've covered more than 1,300 topics, and we've had 7,000 people, almost 7,000 people attending. So it's been quite the event. Okay, so talking about assisting people, and we had a board meeting on the weekend, and one of the things we discussed was how to better serve people, and whether we could extend our outreach, perhaps, the possibility of giving assistance in a one-on-one type mode. So at the end of the Q&A, Chris is going to have a survey question for you. And basically, it's going to ask if you have a question on a basic computing task, so something that's really simple that you need to know. But maybe it's something that lends itself to one-on-one in a remote Zoom session with an experienced member of the club. And as I say, we're considering offering this service, so a lot of that depends on the answers to the survey, I guess. So as it says on the slide, please think about the idea of one-on-one assistance and put your answers in the question when we get to it. Okay, so carrying on, I think we have a follow-up next from an item that we had last week, and that was on wiping a hard drive. And I believe so Ollie is going to talk to these slides.
Yes. So huge thank you to Chris. My Sony Vaio has now been sleeping at Best Buy for quite a while, and he was an immense help to help me to ensure that the hard disk was completely wiped before I sent it to recycling. And I was very concerned about it. And Alan created some wonderful printed instructions that he said it's very easy. And then he shared the very easy instructions. But for me, it wasn't very easy. Partly because wiping the hard disk, I was very afraid that if I did anything wrong, I might wipe the wrong hard disk or the risk of losing data. But it also that I'm not so familiar that even talking about a bootable disk, like to you, that's very common. To me, I was thinking, what is a bootable disk? So at any rate, Chris offered to do an assist outside of this session, and that worked perfectly and wonderfully. So maybe we can go to the next slide. Okay. So Chris sent me information of what I could do to prepare for it, to have my USB ready, a new USB that had nothing on it. And as far as starting the old laptop from a bootable flash drive, I did. Chris, Alan has suggested, I looked that up online, And I tried that, and I came to a screen. I don't know if it will be in these slides, but
yeah, it'll be next.
Wouldn't. Okay. So there we go. So I managed, because I had already erased part of the Windows 10 operating system when I was trying to just erase everything. So it wouldn't boot open. This is as far as I got. I did, following those online instructions, I was able to get to a screen, and I used BIOS to open it. And then I saw this page, and I was able to move things around so that it prioritized being booted by an external device. So this page was correct, but it wouldn't boot. So that was as far as I could get. But Chris clarified that I needed Microsoft Quick Assist, which I looked, and sure enough, it was in my laptop. So I opened it. I saw I just needed a code from Chris when we would get together. So we connected on the phone after I had these things ready. So I was able to open it and put the things on the screen in the correct order. So that was, I didn't know about any of this beforehand. I was able to follow those instructions. So I did all the preparation, was fine. And so that isn't how it showed initially, but so that it was all ready to go, waiting for Chris's further instructions. Okay, next slide. Okay, so this bootable disk thing, you know, I had to understand what does bootable disk mean. And that was the HD Shredder. So we opened up, Chris logged into my laptop, and I opened up the HD Shredder and connected the USB drive. And as far as the two or three ports, I'm not quite sure what that means, but it didn't seem to matter, so that's fine. And then we opened to a boot menu. And, well, first, of course.
Actually, Alan, can you go to the next slide? So this slide that was up now, there now, was just that if instructions were needed to how to get your computer to boot from it, instructions were available on the online, and anybody should be able to find similar instructions for their computer. So now this is when I was connected to her computer over and using remote assistance.
Which was amazing and extremely helpful. So going back to the slide before.
Well, actually, I think we can continue on from here because
okay,
this is what we
on.
Actually did.
Okay.
Yeah. This is what we actually did.
Okay. So the next slide.
Yeah, these are the step-by-step instructions we did.
Okay, so there was the old computer next to me and the new computer. So I downloaded this program, HD Shredder, and we checked the download at VirusTotal, which had a little question about it, but Chris assured me that it was fine. It did show there was a minute possibility of problem, but his judgment, so that was fine. And then installed and ran HD Shredder. And so then HD Shredder created the bootable flash drive, which was in there, and it took a few minutes. So then I had I took the USB key, which was also called the bootable flash drive, and I stuck it into the old laptop, and I restarted the computer. It immediately automatically loaded HD Shredder. And then it asked, complete disk, a secure deletion of the complete disk. So that's what I wanted. So that's what I clicked. And there was only one disk because that was the only choice. So, and then I just pressed start. So, then it took about 3 hours actually to erase it completely. And I was wondering why I had gone to Best Buy to ask if they would do it, and they didn't seem to know anything about this, or they couldn't do it. And I'm wondering if maybe it's because it took 3 hours for it to do that, and they don't want to deal with that kind of thing.
Probably.
Probably. And so that is the whole story. So it was incredible to have Chris's help, and I would say moral support. Like I had the pieces, but I didn't have the confidence to move forward with it. And so with Chris there, I felt confident because he knows what he's doing, even though I don't know what I'm doing. And there you go. My Sony Vaio is gone. So thank you very much, Chris.
My pleasure. It was actually it turned out it was very smooth, very easy to do. And as I say here on the reply back to you, I mean, people are reluctant to take on something that they think is a daunting task and so forth. But as a general rule, if there is a recommendation that is given at Q&A without undue cautions that only experts should deal with it or something like that, generally speaking, it's not too difficult to follow through. But we do realize people's reluctance to take on tasks that who knows what they're really going to do and so forth. And that really is the focus of the survey that is coming up at the end of tonight that Alan talked about. And so stay tuned for that.
And the other thing, Ollie, I'd noticed that once you followed the instructions, it took a little while to set things up. But once you run HD Shredder, the 3 hours is completely automatic, right? It's hands-free at that point. You just let it rip.
Yep.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was just sitting there, and it told me also when approximate time it would be done, which changed. It ended up from the beginning to the end adding about an extra half hour. But it gives you the estimated time that it will be completed. So it was wonderful and easy with Chris's help.
Well, well done. Bob Garrett says, bravo, Ollie.
Yes.
Yes. And also I have
Well,
now the
well done.
USB key that I can use if I wanted to wipe another laptop. So it has HD Shredder on it and it's ready to go.
There you go.
Okay,
Well
thank you very
done.
much. Okay.
Okay, so next up we have Chris talking about SIM swaps and other interesting options.
Yeah, so we talked last week about SIM swaps, and there was a question also that had come in from B on this particular topic, and this referenced the same news article that we talked about last week. And basically, it was in the CBC, well, CBC reported it as well as others, that there was SIM swaps that were going on, and they highlighted that criminals would take over people's phone numbers, and there were over 1,500 accounts that were compromised and over $1 million combined fraud. And so it does sound kind of scary in that. And B wanted to know, are there any specific ideas on protection from particular threat that comes from SIM swaps? Before I forget, I'm going to paste in a whole bunch of links in the chat. There we go. So next slide, Alan. There we go. So what is a SIM swap? So first off, what is a SIM, I guess? SIM stands for Subscriber Identity Module. And it really is just a little like a micro SD card, and it is what ties a phone number to a particular device. So it's the authentication piece that is done between your phone and the cellular network that you're on. And so a SIM swap is where the scammer contacts your mobile phone carrier and tricks them into transferring your phone number to their SIM card. So why or when is this going to be a bad thing? Next. I got slow connection. Okay. So if you have a website that requires two-factor authentication and The second factor is a one-time code that gets sent as a text message to your mobile device. So what happens is the scammer who has contacted your mobile phone carrier tricked them into transferring your phone number to their SIM card. Well, when that text message goes to supposedly your mobile, well, it's no longer going to your mobile. It's going to their phone because they managed to transfer your phone number to their SIM. And so then the scammer who already has to know your username and password for signing on to that particular service, they then get that two-factor authentication code sent, and they enter it in. They can complete the sign-on to your account. Next. So how likely is this, or in fact, any account compromise on any of the web services or services that you're out there using? So rather than just talking about SIM swaps, because this is a very specific portion of authentication, and so I thought it would be useful to step back a little bit, take a deep breath, go down the rabbit hole, and discuss all types of authentication. Where are the risks, and what are the mitigations that are possible? Next. So the first and earliest form of authentication over things like a web service is password-only authentication, or username and password. So you go to a website, you're prompted to sign in, you enter in your username, your password, and you're signed in. And so that's the basic authentication that can happen. Next. So what are the vulnerabilities around this? So someone could guess your credentials. So they could guess your username, which in a lot of cases nowadays, it's an email address that is used for the username. And so a lot of people know what your username is, and then they might guess your credentials. So if you use easily guessed credentials, such as 123456789, as your password, and making it 123456789 doesn't really strengthen it. Or they could hack into the website that is hosting the particular service that you're trying to contact or is trying to utilize, and they could get the encrypted database, download it to their computer, and they use password cracking software to obtain all of the passwords for all the accounts on that particular service. And they can run password cracking software. They can run millions of attempts per second. So they can chug through an awful lot of stuff. And then once they get it, either by guessing or by downloading the encrypted password database, by hacking the website, then they can sign in as you. So that's one vulnerability. What is the mitigation for that? Well, first off, you should always use very long, unique passwords. And I say here preferably over 20 characters. Some people will argue that even higher numbers are, and they're certainly better, higher numbers. But 20 characters is not bad nowadays. And use password manager so that you don't have to remember all of them, because you do want them to be unique on every site. You want them unique on every site so that if somebody cracks a password on one site, they don't automatically have an ability to log in as you on other sites. So don't use dictionary words, common phrases, information about you that people could research over the web or anything like that. And then using a 20-plus character pretty much eliminates the ability to use dictionary words or common phrases. Well, not common phrases. There are some common phrases that are over 20 characters long, but that helps eliminate the ability to use dictionary words and so forth, which are easily cracked. Also, don't give your password to anyone else. Don't write it down where someone else might find it and so forth. And you can also check to see if your email address has been found in data breaches through a web service called Have I Been Pwned? And it's really good because if a hacker does manage to hack a website and get their encrypted database, it's going to still take them some time to get all of the passwords, plain text passwords, for all of the accounts on there. Hopefully, if you find out that they've been hacked, you can go on really quickly, change your password on it, and then that'll stymie them if they, you know, manage to get your old password. So I think the effectiveness of those mitigations are actually pretty good. Next. What's the next vulnerability? So vulnerability number two.
Noting, Chris, that some sites have shorter length limits.
Interesting. I personally haven't run into any websites that have limits lower than that. But yeah, if you do, then make sure you have a really complex password. And yeah, you do the best you can. So the second vulnerability that I identified here is that some websites will provide a way for you to do a password reset if you forget your password by answering security questions such as, you know, where does your, what's your mother's maiden name? Where did you grow up? What city were you born in? Things like that. And so if someone can guess the answers to those or research the answers online, then they can reset the password. And effectively, they can then sign in as you. So just as a clue as to how important it is to not use real answers, apparently one of the common questions for security questions is, what's your favorite food? And 20% of the people have pizza as the answer. So the mitigation for this is use nonsense answers. So city where you grew up, moonbeam. You know, mother's maiden name, bookcase, whatever, not anything that is either honest or even close to responding to the question. And then record the answers in your password manager. So if you ever do need to do a password reset, you can look it up in your password manager and then get the answer and go onto the site and do the reset. To me, the effectiveness of the mitigation is very good on this because nobody's going to be able to guess what the answers are to your security questions. Next. So third vulnerability. So some websites provide a way to reset your password by yourself by sending a reset code. It's usually a URL that gets sent to your email. And then you click on that URL. It goes to the website, prompts you for a new password, and it resets it that way. So if someone can gain access to your email account, they could go to that website, request the password reset. It'll go send that URL off to your email. They can intercept that. And then they can reset the password and lock you out of that account and get access to that original service. Next. So the mitigation for this is really protect your email that is used for password resets. Protect that really highly. Okay, so it's quite important that if it has the ability to get reset codes, that you don't allow the hacker to get into that email. The effectiveness of that is very good, depending on the strength of the protection that you add to the email account. Next. Okay, this one here is, again, we're only talking about password authentication, but SIM swaps start to come into play in here. So this is if you have a service that allows a password reset by sending a reset link to your mobile phone as opposed to your email address. As text message. So one thing I'll say is it's not common, but there are some sites that are known to do this. So if someone can convince your mobile service provider to change the phone number to their SIM, then they could intercept a password reset text message, reset the password, locking you out of the account, and sign in as you. Next. So what's the mitigation for this? First off, If you have the ability to turn it off on a particular website that wants to allow you to do password resets, don't enable password resets through text messaging. That would be a very effective method of getting around this particular vulnerability. You could also ask your phone number to block the ability to move your phone number to a different SIM card unless you show up in person at one of their stores or kiosks or whatever, in person with photo ID, before they'll actually allow a change of your phone number to somebody else's SIM card. So my phone provider, which is Virgin Mobile, they do not have the ability to totally block it. When I called them, they seemed to be, oh, you don't have to worry about it. If anybody calls in and wants a change, it gets handed off to a security area of our company. They'll ask you extra questions and things like that. And I said, no. I said, I don't want to have it that it can be done at all. So they ended up putting it on my file. And they say this note will come up front and center anytime anybody calls in for service on my particular account. And it says that, no, this person does not want their phone number transferred to another SIM card unless they show up at a Virgin Mobile kiosk or store and with photo ID in order to do that change. So that's okay to me as long as they do pay attention to that. And just as a side note, I guess, to it, that if you ever can't access the mobile network, now there is a chance the mobile network is down, but my first thought, if I can't access the mobile network, is that maybe somebody has managed to transfer my phone number to another SIM card. And so I would contact my service provider immediately, and I'll see if that's the case. It could be already too late, but react to it as soon as you can if you have that instance. So I think the effectiveness of that mitigation is actually very, very, very good. Next. So we have a vulnerability number 5. So if an attacker tricks you into going to a lookalike site, and this is actually very common. So my father actually fell for this. So he got an email, and it said, you know, there's a problem with your RBC account. Click here to fix the problem. He went there, and they phished his credentials, his account number and his password, and they took $800 out of his account. So you go to the site. You are actually giving your credentials to the real site, to the attacker, and then the attacker can go onto the real site and sign in as you. Next. So the mitigation for this a good mitigation for this would be to enable two-factor authentication. So there, the attacker then needs to compromise not only your username and password, which they can do through a phishing site like that, but they also need that second factor. So whatever that second factor is going to be, and we're going to talk about those second factors in a minute. So the effectiveness of that mitigation is very good. So just the phishing email is not going to be enough, because that typically will only give up your username and your password. So there was a note from Google a number of years ago that after they implemented two-factor authentication on their internal network, so their employee use, successful phishing attacks on their internal network dropped to 0. So it was very, very effective for Google that they stopped having successful attacks through that means. Next. So let's start talking about then two-factor authentication. So to authenticate through two-factor authentication, you have to first provide a username and a password. And that's a really important thing to consider in here. Next. On top of that, there we go. A second factor is then required. So it's either something you have, something you have. So that typically is going to be a phone that you can receive a text message with a one-time code, or we'll talk about a little bit more, or a security key that you can plug into a USB port to do that second factor. Or it can be something you are. So it's a fingerprint, facial recognition, iris scan are the three most common, fingerprint, facial recognition being the most common by far. Next. So an important thing on here is that you must first provide a username and password. Well, given that username and password only mitigations can be very effective, as we already outlined, adding the second factor, it'll strengthen things, but you are already in a pretty good position. So the two-factor authentication is strengthening something that is already actually fairly effective. Next. But there are vulnerabilities when it comes to two-factor authentication. So vulnerability number 1, so you lose control of that something you have. So somebody who already knows your username and password and gains control of that something you have can sign in as you. So keep in mind that, you know, if typically that something you have for most people is going to be your phone, and keep in mind that there's a lot of information on your phone that can help identify services you use, other sensitive information, usernames that are used and on sites and so forth that can help an attacker. So it's really important to protect your phone. Next. So the mitigation on that, secure that something you have very carefully. Okay. If it's your phone, secure it really well. Don't leave it lying out where somebody could grab it. If you're out and about and you're using your phone, be aware of your surroundings, somebody who can snatch it out of your hand and things like that. So it's really important to secure your phone for many, many reasons, one of them being this ability to defeat two-factor authentication. The effectiveness of that is okay to good, depending on how well you can actually secure your phone or your second device or the something you have. Next. Now we come to a vulnerability number two, and this will be talking about SIM swaps. So if your second factor is that one-time code that gets sent as a text message to your mobile. So we talked a bit about that before, and we talked about it extensively last week. So again, somebody already knows your username and password, and has your phone number transferred to a phone they own, they can intercept a text message with that one-time code and sign in as you. Next. So the first mitigation for this particular vulnerability is to make sure that your phone provider or your service provider will not transfer your phone number to a different SIM card without you showing up in person with photo ID to do it. So it can't be done over the phone. And again, if you ever can't access the mobile network, you know, it could be evidence of a SIM swap, and immediately contact your phone company to get it straightened out. The effectiveness of that mitigation is pretty good as long as you protect your phone very well. Next. We'll talk now about the same vulnerability, but now there's a second mitigation that you have available to it. Next. So mitigation number two for that is to use authentication app as opposed to text messaging for the second factor of authentication. So this is where we talked about this a bunch last week, using authentication apps. And the big difference here is that a text message is tied to your phone number, which is vulnerable to SIM swaps. An authentication app is tied to your phone, and it is not vulnerable to SIM swaps. So the effectiveness of that mitigation is very good to excellent, depending again on how well you protect your phone. Next.
So there's a question, Chris.
Yep.
I think my internet connection's really slow for some reason.
I think so.
There's a question here. If you're a victim of a SIM swap, do you still receive phone calls and text messages?
No, because if a SIM swap happens, your phone can no longer connect to the mobile network because your SIM card is unknown to the service provider now. And so that's where if you can't make a phone call, you can't connect to get emails, you can't get texts, it's either the mobile network is down or you're out of service or whatever, or it could be evidence that a SIM swap has happened. Okay, so vulnerability number three for two-factor authentication. So you get a phishing attack, sends you to a lookalike site, and then the attacker is watching in real time and watching for you to enter your username and your password. When you prompt it to enter your one-time code, you go ahead and you do it, whether it's a text message or an authentication app, and then that is also captured by the attacker. The attacker can then go to the real site, enter your username, password, and the one-time code, again, whether it was from a text message or an authentication app, and then they can log in as you. It can also happen, and I'm not going to go into details on this, it can also happen through a capture of session cookies, which is a way that websites know it's still you while you're navigating on their site, and it's why you're not prompted to log in again and again and again on a website. Once you log in once, session cookies let it know, the website know that it's still you. Well, if somebody can capture those session cookies, then that could allow them to navigate the website as you. So the mitigation for this, I think, is that if you are on a site that requires authentication, never follow a link sent to you via email, text, or whatever. If you get an email that says, you know, you're going out to an information site or click here to see, you know, the OPCUG's upcoming presentations or things like that. That's fine. You don't have to authenticate once you get there. But if you go somewhere through a link and somebody has tricked you and it requires authentication, close out that site immediately. Okay. Only access sites that require authentication from a trusted source. So either a bookmark you have or, you know, some other source of information on the actual URL for it, so you're not tricked into going to a lookalike site. The effectiveness of that mitigation, I think, is very good. Next. So summary and cautions. So any two-factor authentication is going to be stronger than a single factor, username and password, for sure. But be sure to follow all the mitigations for password-only authentication. Next. If you got the choice, you know, authentication apps are going to mitigate more risks than codes that get sent via text messages. So it mitigates the SIM swap vulnerability, but keep in mind, it doesn't mitigate the vulnerability of an attacker who has a lookalike site or whatever and collects that username, password, and the one-time code when you think you're on Bank of Montreal website, but you're on an attacker's website. Next. So keep in mind that even two-factor authentication can be defeated. And this is an important point here. There's no such thing as perfect security. So Gene Spafford, affectionately known as SPAF, computer security expert from many, many years at Purdue University, said the only truly secure system is one that's powered off, cast in a block of concrete, sealed in a lead-lined room with armed guards, and even then he had his doubts. Next. So with passwords, I go back to the idea that it is possible to mitigate most of the risks associated with your accounts being compromised just on the username and the password. With passwords, length trumps complexity. So blue skies are falling down, as you see there. A 23-character non-complex password is actually 70 times stronger, or it has that many more possible passwords in it, than a 19-character complex password. So a bit of a wake-up call on that, where length trumps complexity, and it's easier for you to remember and type in. Next. So here's an interesting example here. Four fives with a plus sign, and then you do that again and again and again. 24-character password, that's actually a very, very strong password. Why? Because the attacker doesn't know that you've just used numbers and the plus sign. If you get to the point where the attacker can no longer attack the password looking at it through a dictionary attack or the 1 million most common passwords used, that they can very easily run through those, once you defeat them at that level, then they're into a brute force attack. Once you're into a brute force attack where they just have to try everything, then length is the absolute best thing that you can go with to make sure that things are secure. When you get up to a 24-character password, even with a password cracker that can crack millions of passwords a second, you're talking about centuries to be able to crack all passwords. Next.
I saw an interesting article suggesting that one thing you can do to make it more complex is to use emojis, which are valid characters.
That's true, and the one caution I have on that is that there is possibility that some systems might not accept it. So, you know, you have to be a little bit cautious about that. So if a service permits multiple means of password recovery, and some of them will do that, they will say you can either do a password recovery through answering a security question, or we can send you a text message, or we can send you an email with a reset link to the email address that we have on record for you. So the weakest means is always going to trump stronger means. So, for example, if you can use either an authentication app or an email message with a one-time code, well, almost certainly the attacker is going to try to attack the email message because it's going to be easier for them to defeat that second means of authentication rather than doing the authentication app. So if you have multiple means, look at the different means that are provided for you and look at whatever is the weakest one, and you have to either eliminate that or make sure it is very strongly protected as well. Next. Okay, think about digital legacy. I said don't write your password down and don't tell other people. Well, maybe not quite as hard line on that as I let on, because you really should be thinking about whether somebody can handle your accounts in the case of incapacity or death. You don't want your accounts to be locked so tight that nobody can access them. You want to be able to give access, probably, to a very limited number of people. I talk about this in my Keeping Passwords Safe presentation that I gave at the Our Public Library, and it's very important to consider that. I can go into detail another time about that if you want. Next.
And Natalie just posted that your OPL session on October the 10th at Alta Vista is now online somewhere for registration.
That's great. Thank you, Natalie. So think about giving the highest form of protection on the your highest value services or accounts. I play games at pogo.com. Do I care if that account gets compromised? No. I'll just create a brand new account. So I don't care about that. But I have a unique password on it, so if somebody does compromise it, they don't automatically gain access to my bank account or my email address or things like that. So think about those high-value services and put the biggest effort into making sure that they are really secure. Next. Now, this is also an important concept. If you have very strong means of authentication, it also means you're more likely to be accidentally locked out from a service if that, you know, strong form of authentication is compromised somehow. So think about what happens if your second factor is unavailable. If it is a phone, whether it's a text message or an authentication app, if you lose that phone, what are you going to do? You know, so think about those sort of things as well. Next. And a whole bunch of resources. So Password Manager, I talked about that a little bit. So we have articles that we have had in the newsletter on keeping passwords safe through using password managers. I highly, highly, highly recommend using password managers. Good way to keep things secure. Have I Been Pwned? I mentioned about that. It's an excellent free service where you can find out if your email address shows up in a data breach. Not only can you go and test your email address at the website, you can also subscribe so that if it shows up in the future, they will actually email you and tell you, oh, your email address showed up in a data breach. You can then go to that website, change password right away, and defeat the attackers if they get around to managing to crack your password with a password cracking tool. If you're interested in strength of passwords, how big is your haystack? Is Gibson Research Corporation. They have a website where you can put in any password, and it'll tell you how many centuries it can take to crack that password, or if it's a very weak password, maybe it'll only take 5 minutes or less. And we have the Ottawa Public Library presentations, Keeping Your Password Safe, and I actually have it coming up twice that is scheduled for this fall. And so if you're interested, come on out to that. Next. And this is my final slide. So defeating two-factor authentication. If you're interested in just some of the details behind how two-factor authentication can be defeated, there's a couple of links there on your screen, and these are all in the chat window as well. And that's all I had for tonight.
Okay, Chris, there's a note here from Elizabeth, a response from her bank when she asked for two-factor authentication. And they say that they have a mechanism in place which they call a one-time verification code.
Yeah.
But there's no way to set that up for every login.
No, that's a one-time authentication code, if I'm understanding it correctly, and Virgin had this as well, is that when you call in, they have an authentication code that you would have to give in order to get service, whether it's, you know, finding out what your bill is or doing a SIM swap. So that is the four-digit code thing that they were talking about at Virgin. That, to me, is insufficient. Because I have that recorded in my password keeper, but still, it's a matter of if somebody was managed to get into my password vault, they could get that code, or they might guess that code. or something like that. So I would go beyond that and tell them that that's insufficient, that what you want is that you cannot change your phone number to a different SIM card without showing up in person. And that's really the gold standard.
She's talking about a bank, Chris, not a phone company.
Yeah, but this is for getting the two-factor authentication.
Yeah, but how do you force the bank to do it?
Yeah, so again, it's if the bank is doing their two-factor authentication through a text message or an authentication, code sent to your phone, then you fall back to the fact that you want to prevent that SIM swap from happening. Okay. If it's that you are going to the bank and you're talking to them on the phone and they say, what's your four-digit secret code? Mm-hmm. At that point, yeah, I guess that's really about all you can do is go with that. Make sure you protect that four-digit code very, very well so that nobody can call into the bank and impersonate you.
Yeah. Or go to the bank physically.
Yeah, you could always do that too. You could say, I don't want to be able to do anything over the phone for banking, and therefore I want you to refuse service if somebody calls in saying they're me. And at that point, yeah, you have to end up going into the bank, and talking to them in person.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris.
Any other questions that came in? Or
didn't notice anything. I'm just thinking about that bank thing again. Still, Elizabeth says that she was asking for two-factor authentication. And they were saying that they have a mechanism in place, but they don't use it for every login. That seems really weird for a bank.
Alterna doesn't have two-factor authentication.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, there are some even banks that don't. And so they rely on username and password. In those cases, like what I did with Alterna, is that you can go into their configuration or their account settings on their website, and you can say that you want to be notified if there is a successful login to your account. And I've enabled that. So absolutely every time I go and log in at Alterna, I get an email, usually within a minute, saying that a successful login happened. Well, if I didn't log in and I get that email, then I'm going to be on the phone to the bank immediately saying, please lock my account.
Alterna also has a very short password limit, which you probably remember, about 12 or 15 characters. But I did talk to the security guy at an Alterna corporate meeting or the annual general meeting, and they said that they have other checks as well as to, where the login is coming from and so on. So, for example, you might have difficulty accessing it from a VPN if you're out of the country,
right,
or if you're out of the country using any kind of local IP.
Yeah, I think a lot of banks will do that as well, that they look for, strange locations for logins and things like that, or distant changes that they think are suspicious, and they'll lock accounts because of that.
There's a question here, Chris. Are you vulnerable to SIM swap if you have a data-only account on an MIFI hub and use VoIP?
Yes, because it's still going to come down to the SIM card. Let me see. Yeah, I think so, because if the only way you're going to get that code sent is because the phone company knows. Well, if it's a text message, it definitely would be vulnerable, because the only way that that text message is going to get to you is because the phone company that you're subscribed with knows how to get to your SIM card, essentially, is what they're getting to. And so if that SIM swap happens, it's going to get sent to somebody else. But if you're not using text messages, then you wouldn't be vulnerable to SIM swaps.
I think they mean a VoIP service like Fongo, which is not connected to the phone company and is really not connected to your SIM. It's only connected by the
true
app.
Yeah, that's true. Right? So it's strictly a phone number, yeah.
But I don't think that doesn't use the SIM card at all, so that would probably be more free and more safe to use than your regular phone number.
Yeah, as long as you've protected access to that phone number so that you you know, that other people can't abuse that particular phone number, yeah.
So there was a comment here from Natalie that she says, sadly, sometimes security when dealing over the phone comes down to the diligence of the agent and how easily they can be swayed or fooled.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I didn't want it that, you know, oh, yes, well, you have to answer this for this PIN, or we will transfer you over to, you know, a security a part of our department that will ask you additional questions. Well, I don't want that. I want the diligence to be, you know, absolute. You know, you just can't do it over the phone, period. You know, that's what I want. And that's what hopefully is going to happen with Virgin. But yeah, it does require somebody on that phone to actually bring up my account. Notice that I've got a thing on my file saying, do not transfer a SIM except in person. But yeah, it does require the diligence of the people at the other end to do that.
You might want to, if you talk to the phone company, you might want to ask them, okay, will you be liable if I get gypped out of $20,000 or $30,000 because my bank account got access?
Well, again, I come back to my first vulnerabilities on username and password only, and it is possible to make that secure. So while, you know, two-factor authentication will undoubtedly strengthen it, I have no qualms about the fact that I use Alterna and they don't have two-factor authentication because I have a username and a password, and the password is a secure password. I have no qualms about, you know, that that's strong enough that it's going to resist attack. You know, so, yeah, it's great to use two-factor authentication, but you should be using good enough practices with your passwords that you don't have to rely on two-factor authentication. So people shouldn't freak out about SIM swaps. I bet that first statistic of 1,500 people in that newsletter, that CBC article, 1,500 accounts that were compromised, I would be willing to bet absolutely every one of them had weak passwords, because you first have to get through that before you can successfully launch a SIM swap attack. So I'd be willing to bet that.
And talking about banks having different requirements for 2FA, apparently some banks have different rules for different people. And Elizabeth said that she was complaining that the agent said they only, and they couldn't do it for every login. And she says her bank is Simply. Allison says she's with Simply and she gets the one-time verification every time.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you're kidding. I'm going to call them.
Alan and Chris.
Harvey had a note here that TD Bank only requests two-factor authentication periodically. I think, Harvey, you may find that that's an option. And I have mine so that it asks me every time. But I think you can tell it to do it occasionally if you wish. So you might find that's just an option, a setting somewhere.
Yeah, I'm with TD in that. That's just the case. You can tell it not to ask you every time, but you can, if you just leave it, it does ask you every time.
Rosemary had a question. Could use a different username than an email. Some sites only permit the use of an email, and what they'll do is when you're setting up the account, they will send an email to make sure that it's a real person sort of idea. So they'll send it to the email address. Some sites will allow you to just pick a username at random. And whenever I can, I use that. And I record it in my password manager. So in that case, it's less likely that somebody's going to be able to successfully attack my account because they don't know it's me. They don't know what the username is on there. So whenever I can use just a made-up username, and I use that at Canada Revenue, I set up an account with them, and I just used the username. It's not my email address. Oh, Karen has her hand up.
Hi, guys. A couple of things. Tom mentioned something about a FIDO USB or something. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about. I've got a few questions here, so I'll just leave that one. Maybe we can, once I say all my questions. Wonder, Tom, if you can talk a little bit more about that. I'm wondering, how prevalent is this SIM swap thing? It's kind of the first time that, well, no, I guess I've heard about it, but not quite in the way that you guys are talking about it. I just had a situation with RBC today where they're interjecting two-factor authentication in all different sorts of places that they haven't done it before. And so just allow yourself a little bit more time, because I was a bit pressed time for making an e-transfer today, and all of a sudden I ended up in this really complex two-factor authentication. It locked me out after a period of time, and otherwise, so I ended up having to call RBC Security around that. So just letting folks know that banks and RBC, as I talked with them a little bit about it, they're trying to introduce these things and not announcing it. So that was an unexpected for me today. Whoever had Simply, I also have Simply, and I have it set up, and I have to do two-factor authentication every single time. And maybe just looping back to Tom now.
Hi. Okay, sure. I have a couple of FIDO keys. I look like this, if you can see my picture. They are, you can get them in just plain old USB or USB-C, or they can work with a NOC. I forget so they'll work kind of like pay with your card. They have a little Wi-Fi, not Wi-Fi, what am I thinking of? At any rate, you can use them with a NOC to use with your phone or something like that. And what they do is they serve as another factor of authentication. So, for example, you can plug them into your laptop or plug them into your phone. And some, I think, even connect by Bluetooth, although I'm not sure about that. I wouldn't like it. They serve as another factor of authentication. If you do decide to try to go that route, I would suggest getting two of them. And the current edition is FIDO 2, and you can even use that as a way to log in to your Windows computer. They come with a little button on them, and when you're prompted to push the button, you push the button. And then that serves as instead of a password for logging into your computer, for example, or as a second factor for doing other stuff or even logging into your computer. I'm not sure if you can set up your computer for two-factor authentication. So that's the FIDO. FIDO is the original version of the USB key, and FIDO 2 is the current version.
Serge Rodrigue, do you have your hand up?
Can you hear me well?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to share with you something. I had to contact TD yesterday, Visa session, about a charge that was on my card that I did not recognize. They went through all the normal, what's your name, what's your account number, and your address and everything. And then I called twice, and both times they asked me if they could send me a code. So they did that. So I'm glad they did. But the reason I was calling is because I was victim of a fraud since August 13. That charge that was on my card, which read CR Registry in all in caps for $33.89, was from the Social Housing Registry of Ottawa. So I got transferred at TD, and I got to the section where they could tell me what this charge was from, who this charge was from. And I called the registry yesterday, and there was a message on their website that they had been a victim of a fraud. So that's my adventure this week. So Visa is canceling the charge, and that's what happened to me. So I suggest you check your Visa or MasterCard for an entry called CR Registry, all in uppercase, CRI registry 888-454-6364.
Hey, thanks, Ajit.
Okay, well, thanks, everyone. We had a really good discussion on that. Anybody who is desperate to learn all about bridge, I'm afraid we're going to have to postpone that. But I do want to go. Chris wants to go to his survey question.
Yes. Okay, let me see if I can launch this. They've changed some things on, okay, polls, quizzes. Okay. Do people see it on the screen now?
I don't.
Okay. Okay, hang on a second.
Yes, I see it. One-on-one remote assistance question.
No, that's not the poll itself. That's
no. Yeah, just a second. I just got to launch it. There, you see it now?
Nope.
No.
Okay. Oh, one more button. Okay, there we go.
Oh, I see it.
Okay, so we'll leave that on the. So just say the, again on this, the idea is that we had some people, I'm sure, that like Ollie, who was reluctant to take on something that was fairly straightforward, and she realizes after the fact that it was fairly straightforward, but didn't seem so at the time. So we're looking to see, are there other people who, you know, really feel that they have some things that could be solved if, you know, people could connect over the internet, see their screen, and say, okay, now click on this, now click on this, and explain, oh, okay, I see this dialog box that you're confused about. You know, this is what it really means, or let's investigate it further. And so are there people who could actually use that if we set it up? There's no promises as it stands right now. It will always be remote assistance. It's not going to be anybody showing up and sitting beside you at your computer, but they'd be able to see your screen, and optionally you'd be able to give them control so that they could actually use your mouse and keyboard and take you through things. So we're just seeing, is there interest in this? What types of things people are actually interested in? And so if you can go ahead and answer those questions, and I see now, and those who are co-hosts do not have the ability to answer it. So Alan and Tom, you're not able to answer the poll. And we've had 13, 14, 16. I'll leave it up for just a couple more seconds. Yeah, we still got ones coming in. Okay, so we're up to 28. Okay, I think 29. I was thinking, just close it off and then just, oh, 30. So 30 of 39, so we're getting close to everybody having answered it. Okay, I think that this will probably give us a little bit of information about how much people are actually interested in. We only have two who said that they wouldn't take advantage of it. We have 29 currently who say that this is something that they could be possibly interested in having. So the board will consider further if there are people out there who would like to volunteer to be on the giving end of if people have problems, that they could you know, be put in touch with the person, they could work it out when they can do this remote assistance and so forth. Let us know. At suggestionbox@opcug.ca is probably as good an address as any. And then we'll see if we can actually put something together on this. So I am going to now close the poll and I can share the results. So there's the results on the screen now. So you can see what the breakdown actually is.
I don't see the results, Chris.
I had a button saying share. Oh, is that share results?
It just keeps popping up with my what I answered. It pops that up. It pops up with my answer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I had a button that said share results, and I did that, and that's all I can do. So, any rate, we've got the information. So that's great. Thank you very much, everybody, for your participation in that. And I will just capture.
And for people's information, that. Windows operating system, issues with software and hardware issues are about 80%, and networking is about 66%.
Yeah. So, yeah, spread across the spectrum.
A pretty broad interest in all those different topics.
Yeah.
Plus,
yeah.
A third of the people are interested in something else.
Yeah. So I think the takeaway from that for the board is that, yes, there is interest in it, and it's a broad spectrum of types of problems that people are looking to for solutions that they don't think will be effectively done through Q&A sessions, regular sessions, I guess. So we will definitely consider that, and we will let you know as we make decisions on that. So I'm going to cancel that out and let Alan wrap up the session.
Okay, so thanks very much to Ollie and Chris for making those presentations, and everybody for joining in the discussion. Apologies to Tom, we didn't get to your bridge item, but we'll schedule that later. And a couple of announcements. I just want to remind you that Linda has an upcoming lecture on macro photography on Monday, August the 26th, and there's a link on screen there. It will be in the deck. Chris will probably put it in the chat before we leave.
Yes.
So if you're interested in that, then Linda will be happy to see you. And I'll just make a note that if I can find my controls. The September monthly meeting is September the 11th, and this guy called Alan German, I guess that's me, I'm going to be talking about building a website without needing any HTML coding. So if you're desperate to create a website but you don't know anything about HTML, that session may be of interest to you. Next week we will have a Q&A, August the 28th, next Wednesday, and we already have a pretty full agenda for that meeting, as it turns out. But if you do have other questions that you want to ask, by all means, send us a note to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll try our best to answer your questions. And so thanks very much, everyone, for attending. I hope you enjoyed the session tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Thanks.